what do we think of most of all when we think of Muslim-Christian relations in the Middle Ages? Probably the thing that comes to mind is something like this, or possibly something like this. The narratives of conflict between Christian and Muslims in the Middle Ages are certainly well known to everyone. Oppression, territorial conflict, execution, battles. This is the stuff of story and history book and many movies and popular culture. And these sorts of narratives have formed the basis for a well-known narrative known as the Clash of Civilizations, according to which Christianity and Islam are two fundamentally opposed modes of civilization that are permanently in conflict with each other, never to be in any way reconciled. This is something that ISIS has picked up in their propaganda. So it's certainly a widespread narrative, and you'll see this also in the news and in popular commentary. Now, I'm certainly not here to deny the conflict-laden aspects of Muslim-Christian interactions in the Middle Ages, but that history neglects a very important part of the shared history of Muslims and Christians in the Middle Ages. And that is their shared intellectual history. Now, the intellectual history has also been, in the textbooks, a kind of there's been a kind of crusade narrative that has entered into how we think about Muslim and Christian interactions in the Middle Ages as well. So if you've ever been to the Louvre, one of the very important pieces of art that you may have rushed past on your way to take a selfie with the Mona Lisa is this piece here called The Triumph of Thomas Aquinas by Benozzo Gozzoli. You see Thomas Aquinas throned here in splendor with various doctors and philosophers and theologians around him. He's triumphing over error, and we might wonder, who's that guy that he's crushing under his feet? That would be Averroes, who's an important Muslim commentator on Aristotle from Cordoba. And we'll be talking a little bit more about him later. But this is a well-known narrative about medieval scholasticism, that Arabic philosophy comes in to corrupt genuine Aristotelian doctrine, and Thomas Aquinas is one of the champions who shoves away and defends Christian theology from the incursions of Muslim error. It's something that's relatively prominent in sort of textbook kind of overviews from maybe from 50 years ago or so. Now, let's look at perhaps a different image that I think represents another piece of history that doesn't get talked about as much. This is a 14th century manuscript illustration of a classroom at the University of Paris. These are students. You can see students in medieval Paris have differing degrees of engagement with the material as they do today. But we might wonder, who's the guy who's sitting in the chair of the magister, the teacher, teaching, lecturing to the students at the University of Paris? That's Avicenna, a Persian philosopher who died in 1037. Of course, he died before the University of Paris was ever founded, but he's portrayed here in this medieval illumination as being someone who's teaching at the university because his thought was so important for the formation of scholastic thought. In fact, I think it's no exaggeration to say that the translation of the works of Avicenna are a fundamental shifting point that change European thought forever and make scholasticism into what we know of it today. Many of the doctrines that we associate now with Thomas Aquinas and with scholastic thought have their roots precisely in Avicenna and in other Arabic thinkers. So there's a sense in which it's true, perhaps, to say that there would be no Middle Ages in the sense of medieval scholasticism without the Middle East. And that's the story, that's the part of the story that doesn't get told very much that I want to tell you today. And we're going to do that in two parts. First, I'm going to give you a bit of a historical overview to talk about how the texts made their way from one place to another. There's a very interesting sort of journey that they take. And then we're going to look at one specific case of influence, of specifically Averroes, on a key philosophical and theological concept in Aquinas that continues to be present in Catholic theology, in Catholic theological reflection today. All right. So first of all, let's think about the story about how knowledge is handed on in the ancient and medieval world. So it's really easy for us to forget now that we have access to texts that are translated and easily disseminated in print or online, how difficult it is for knowledge to move from place to place before those kinds of technologies are invented. So you might think about if you wanted to study Plato and Aristotle or the great philosophical movements of late antiquity, where would you have to go in order to study them in, let's say, the 5th and 6th centuries AD? This is maybe not showing up very well. There's three centers that you might go to. Of course, you could pick a sage, any sage, someone that was famous, go travel to them, sit at their feet, learn what they have to tell you. But if you wanted to something a little bit more systematic, there were places, academies that you could go. One of them is in Athens, one of them is in Alexandria, Egypt, and there's another one, the third star over on the right-hand side in the domain of the Sassanids in Persia, that's the Academy of Gundishapur. That has a strong emphasis on astronomy, mathematics, and then also philosophy. Now, this is where the, say, beating heart of philosophical reflection is in late antiquity. And now, if we fast forward to the time of Thomas Aquinas, to the rise of the great universities of Northern Europe, Oxford and Paris, they're all tapping into this tradition several hundred years later, up here where the blue stars are. So we might ask ourselves, how does the knowledge get from this sort of cultural center around the Mediterranean up to Northern Europe? And it's easy to sort of imagine that, well, I don't know, there were connections between these two places, trade, the Roman Empire spread up north, they just took the knowledge with them. And that's actually not true. So in Northern Europe, up until the middle of the 12th century, there's no access to the writings of Plato, except for half of a Platonic dialogue, the Timaeus. And there's also no access to the works of Aristotle other than a few books of logic that are translated by Boethius into Latin. And so it's kind of shocking to consider, because we don't imagine Europe as being very small or very large, how it was that knowledge could just get lost and not accessed for that number of centuries while it continued to thrive in schools around the Mediterranean. But that's in fact what happened. And so the journey that it takes is not so much a journey north, but it's a journey that goes south through the north of Africa up into Spain and from Spain into Northern Europe in the 12th century. And we'll talk about how that happened. So to understand how the knowledge traveled, we need to know what the role was of the Muslim world in developing this philosophical tradition and handing it on. So Muhammad, by the time that Muhammad dies in 638, Islam has spread largely through the Arabian Peninsula. There's infighting, if people are familiar with the history of Islam, there's a lot of infighting that happens in terms of who's going to succeed Muhammad. And the dynasty that eventually consolidates power in 661 is the Umayyad dynasty. And that's the one that's responsible for some of the really big military incursions at the time. So you can see from the map here, there's some really wonderful maps from the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Chicago, so you can look these up. But you can see that the map sort of documents in green the expansion into, so there's a conquest of Persia, there's expansion into North Africa, there's expansion into southern Spain. Now, the Umayyads are very, very good at conquering things, but they're not very good at keeping the various people that they conquer happy. So there's a revolt in 750 that's partially steered by Shia Muslims who are very dissatisfied with the Sunni Muslim control of the Umayyad dynasty, and also by Persian Muslim converts who feel like second-class citizens in the Umayyad Empire. They get together and they revolt against the Umayyads, slaughter all the members of the family, but one 20-year-old prince escapes. His name is Abd al-Rahman. You'll have to remember him because we're going to come back to him later. In any case, he flees. He disappears from the picture for the moment. The Abbasids take over, and they've got this enormous territorial empire. They also have a great deal of influence from Persia and the cultural knowledge from Persia. And they decide that now that they've got all of this military success, it's time to settle down and really consolidate their status in the world around the Mediterranean as a huge cultural power. So they decide, what are they going to do in order to gain this cultural prominence? Well, they have a very smart idea. They move the capital to Baghdad from Damascus. There's the founding of the city of Baghdad. You can see a map that was known as the Round City of Baghdad at the time. And they decided that in order to gain cultural prominence, what they had to do is support philosophy, poetry, the arts, mathematics, and astronomy. And so as a result, they begin to gather manuscripts obsessively, and they build a library. And scholars, of course, if you have a library, scholars are going to come because they want to look at the manuscripts. So as they're collecting the library, they're also beginning to build a kind of circle of translators. And there's a few translators in this movement that are particularly influential. We're just learning about the role of them as Nestorian Christian translators, play an important role in getting the material from Greek into Syriac, and then from Syriac into Arabic. And we know that there were teams of people who were working together on these translations. It must have been an enormous and very expensive kind of endeavor. But it went on particularly in this is roughly the 8th and 9th centuries that this is going on. So as a result, if you put all of this money into supporting intellectual activities, people start producing stuff. And so what they do is, what we see here is in Baghdad becomes a kind of center for philosophical knowledge, particularly in the 9th and 10th centuries. So one of the key figures here is Al-Kindi. He's on the postage stamp on the left. And the circle of Al-Kindi is probably responsible to the greatest degree for bringing late Neoplatonic philosophy into the Islamic tradition and making it palatable to an Islamic audience. And so we see Al-Kindi defending the philosophical tradition of the Greeks here, which of course, whenever these sort of cultural transmissions happen, there's always a little bit of worry. If this is transmission, these are ideas that are coming from outside our culture, is that okay for us to bring them in? See, this happened with Augustine, has to defend bringing in Greek philosophy to Christian theology. So there's moments in different religious traditions where this has to happen. We see this moment particularly with Al-Kindi, and he writes, "We should have great gratitude to the philosophers of the Greeks who have contributed even a little of the truth, for they have shared with us the fruits of their thought and facilitated our study of the true hidden essences. If they had not lived, these true principles which have led us to the conclusions of our hidden inquiries would not have been assembled for us, even with intense research throughout our time." This is highly controversial at the time, but Al-Kindi makes his case and is successful, and an enormous tradition of philosophical reflection develops in Baghdad and around Baghdad at the time. So Al-Kindi's circle is one of the big drivers of this, but we also see Al-Farabi on the other postage stamp, who is instrumental particularly in bringing the Aristotelian tradition to bear on Islamic thought. Another important thinker to mention here is Avicenna, or Ibn Sina. He's a Persian thinker, dies in 1037. He's the one that I mentioned is depicted in the illustration that we saw earlier, sitting in the chair, he's the seat of the master at the University of Paris lecturing. And I tend to think that if we were extracting thinkers from the history of philosophy, and we're evaluating who are the greatest 10 thinkers of the entire history of philosophy, one of them would surely be Avicenna. So he's probably one of the most creative and brilliant minds of the Greco-Arabic Latin tradition. Certainly he belongs up there with Plato and Aristotle. He's a brilliant metaphysician. He's also a practicing physician, which is sort of an interesting thing. There was a tendency to combine medicine and philosophy, care for the body and care for the soul in this tradition. So we see him administering medical treatment over there in the corner, as well as philosophical knowledge in the other corner. Now, of course, he's also famous for having a very strongly positive opinion of himself. So he tells us in his autobiography that he was so brilliant that he was teaching all of his teachers by the age of 12. And he was also so handsome that when he would go to prayers at the mosque, all the women would turn out on the streets to see him go by. Make sure to tell us that in his autobiography. All right. We might wonder then, how did so this, and this is such a quick overview, you're not even really going into the content of these traditions, but there's an enormous body of philosophical knowledge that's developed over a set of centuries in the Middle East and in Persia, what's now modern-day Iran, and in northern Egypt. So we might say, well, how does that knowledge then get, in time for European universities, how does that get up to northern Europe, exactly? At the time, there's not a lot going on in northern Europe in terms of philosophical development. So we can pick out some really important figures that are doing philosophy at the time these philosophical traditions are developing in the Islamic world, people like Eriugena. But up until about the 12th century, there's not really these large-scale philosophical movements that are developing and doing highly creative things in northern Europe. And we really start seeing that happen only really in the 12th century. And as that's getting started in the 12th century, we also see suddenly the incursion of Greek and Arabic texts that are being translated into Latin. Now, why did that happen in the 12th century? One reason is described in there's a way in which we could see a kind of parallel thing that happened to the development with the Abbasids and the founding of Baghdad. Once you achieve a certain degree of economic stability, it's time to start thinking about cultural production. And Northern Europe is stabilizing politically and economically to the point of being able to support these kind of large-scale scholarly movements. And they look to the Islamic world and they have some concerns about not having caught up to the level of, especially mathematical, astronomical, medical knowledge are some of the things that they're particularly interested in. So they begin to translate those texts first, having worries that they've gotten behind. But philosophical texts follow soon afterwards. And we can possibly see the rise of the universities that happens right about the end of the 12th century as being also a kind of driver of demand for accessing new texts. But there's another reason possibly that this text translation movement starts. And we can see that if we consider where exactly it starts. The little dot on the map there marks the primate cathedral of Toledo in Spain. And Toledo is the epicenter in the middle of the 12th century, into the beginning of the 13th century, of a huge wave of translations that are sponsored by the Archbishop of Toledo. We happen at the cathedral there. And they involve Jewish and Christian translators translating texts from Arabic, philosophical texts from Arabic, into Latin. We don't know exactly why it started there, what the interests were that people had, why they translated the text they did. This is all research that's ongoing. But we can have a few guesses as to some possible factors here. If we look at where Toledo is exactly in Spain, it's recently been reconquered from the Muslims in the earlier part of the 12th century. And it's just across the border from the large portion that's still of Spain, that's still under control, known as Al-Andalus, or now Andalusia, the province of Spain. And the major cultural center there is Cordoba, marked with a yellow star on the map. Now, Cordoba gained a huge amount of cultural prominence in the Middle Ages due to, initially, the Umayyad descendant who fled from the slaughter of his family, Abd al-Rahman. Where did he go? He traveled through northern Africa and up into this area in southern Spain, which was held by people who were loyal to his family. And there he decided that he was going to found his own caliphate. It became called the Caliphate of Cordoba. And it was going to compete with all of the crazy things those Abbasids were going to do, and he was going to show them, and he was going to make it an even better cultural center than what they were trying to do. And he was largely successful in attracting scholars to Cordoba. There was a huge flourishing in both trade and intellectual activities in Cordoba in the medieval period. One of the things that is remarkable, perhaps, about Cordoba is the size that it grew to during the medieval period. In fact, travelers would remark on the fact that you would start to encounter settlements so far out from the city center as you were traveling closer and closer into the city. So it was the largest city in terms of population in Europe at the time. Now, in Cordoba, is the Great Mosque of Cordoba, which is still there. There's a lot of money flowing into the city. There's two famous thinkers that you might have heard of that come from Cordoba precisely in the 12th century. One of them is Moses Maimonides, the famous Jewish scholar. The other one is Ibn Rushd, or Averroes, known as the commentator for those who read Aquinas. Averroes' commentaries became so popular in that's a little loaded. They may be popular, it's a bit too strong. They became widely read in medieval Paris, and they were largely instrumental in filtering how people were understanding Aristotle. So if you're trying to read Aristotle and you don't understand what he's saying, you would probably turn to a commentary to try to figure out. And Averroes had extensive commentaries on Aristotle that got translated into Latin. So Cordoba, big center of knowledge. Now, if we think about the timing here, in 1147, the Almohads, who are a particularly fierce and anti-intellectual branch of, represented a fierce and anti-intellectual branch of Islam, invaded from the north of Africa into the south of Spain and drove out the strongholds of what had formerly been the Caliphate of Cordoba. And as they were approaching Cordoba, Jews and Christians fled the city. They fled north to Toledo. And also Muslims who feared reprisals from the Almohads also fled. And there's some evidence that they probably took their libraries with them when they fled, because they had enough advance warning when they were coming. So this is very patchy historically. We're not quite sure exactly how this all worked. But the timing seems just about right for this influx of people coming from Cordoba into Toledo, fleeing there, and then all of a sudden, a few years later, this big translation movement starts. It's possible that they took the text with them, and all of a sudden it became accessible to people who wanted then to send them on to universities in Paris. So this is all happening in the 12th century. The texts are getting translated into Latin. They're beginning to enter into the curriculum at the University of Paris in about the first third of the 13th century. And this is basically just the right timing for them to start to get established right as Thomas Aquinas is beginning his studies as a bachelor at the University of Paris at the beginning of the 1250s. All right. So that's the quick overview of the text transmission history. But let's think a little bit about an example of how the influence goes, what kinds of ideas made their way into Latin thought. We're still working on documenting them all because the medieval thinkers are not particularly good at telling you where their ideas come from. They don't have these tendencies for documenting their own originality. And they figure it's a good idea, it doesn't matter where it comes from, you don't have to put the name of a person in, they just take them. So you have to sort of do a lot of research trying to put piece together where these things are coming from. We can document some specific areas where these influences come in. So Thomas Aquinas is our sort of hero of the day, 1225 to 1274. He's one of the big champions, perhaps, of Aristotelian, Neoplatonic, Arabic thought at the University of Paris, him and his teacher, Albert the Great. And if we look at some of the general areas in which ideas from the Islamic philosophical tradition enter into Aquinas' thought, we can see just as a few examples, things like arguments for God's existence, arguments for the immateriality of the soul, theories of creativity of God, theories of God's intimate presence to us, The idea that angels are sheer minds is something that comes out of late antiquity and that through the Islamic tradition gets developed by Aquinas in the Christian tradition as well. Causation in the natural, there's theories of causation have a strong dependence. Something I'm particularly interested in, theories of light and color are something that are very highly dependent on Avicenna. The brain's role in processing sensory info, ideas about animal instinct. Islamic philosophers are especially interested in animal psychology for some reason, and so a lot of those theories are quite highly developed as they enter into the Latin tradition. Then also topics having to do with how we as human beings know an abstract concept, let's say like beauty or humanity. And I want to take one example of specifically Averroes' influence in Aquinas' theory of the beatific vision. The beatific vision being the Christian doctrine according to which the soul beholds God face to face after death, is the reward of the just. Now, I think this example is particularly interesting for a few reasons. First of all, it's a great little example of how philosophical reflection in scholasticism carries along or helps theological reflection, so this kind of partnership between philosophy and theology. It's also a doctrine that goes back to Averroes specifically, who's supposed to be the bad guy in scholasticism. So it's really interesting to see Aquinas bringing in something from Averroes to an idea that's so core to Christian theology, and I think it is evidence of the respect that he has for Averroes' philosophical solutions, even though he argues against him in other ways. Okay, so if we picture experiencing God in the afterlife, what does that look like? Well, we have plenty of visual representations of this sort of thing. We can sort of imagine God as an old man. Typically, there's clouds. Human beings look like human beings. We're wandering around and sort of beholding God with our eyes. It's all very visual. Or in a less irreverent frame of mind, Deuter's Adoration of the Trinity, you can see the same sort of elements. There's conventional ways of depicting God and with a kind of elderly and therefore reverential demeanor, but human beings, again, beholding with physical eyes something that looks like a physical body. Now, these are visual expressions of the Christian doctrine of the beatific vision. And the doctrine of the beatific vision comes out of Scripture, specifically, and a promise of about the afterlife from two sources. So, 1 John 3:2, we shall see God as he is. So that as he is very important. And 1 Corinthians 13:12. Catholics never memorize scripture, so I have to actually look at the page here. At present, we see indistinctly as in a mirror, but then we shall see face to face. So this face to face kind of notion, right? It's something that's part of the promise of what the souls in the what we can expect in the afterlife. Now that's very vague, and theologians want to reflect on what exactly this face to face vision would be. And Aquinas, as a theologian, wants to work this out. What does it mean to see God face to face? Well, he argues that this language emphasizes a kind of directness. You want to think about this as a kind of direct encounter or experience of God in his real being, so not mediated by any kind of image or illustration or some kind of aid or symbol or interpretation, but just the kind of immediacy that we have in sensation. Now, if that's the desideratum here, right, this causes an enormous philosophical problem for Aquinas and his contemporaries. If we take a philosophical notion of God, as Aquinas describes, an actuality of all act, source of all being, pure existence, right? The infinite intensity of is. How is that going to be something that a finite human being with finite capacities can experience? there's a mismatch problem. We've got this promise. Seems like this is what we should expect, but there doesn't seem to be any good philosophical way of accounting for it. So there's a few options that one could put forward, of course. And we can think about whether any of those would be plausible. One could say, well, maybe we just take it literally, right? Face to face, as he is, face, eyes, some sort of physical vision, right? As depicted here. Well, Aquinas thinks that's not going to work because God is not a body. So you can't see God as he is with physical eyes. God would have to assume a bodily appearance in order to be visible to bodily eyes. So physical seeing is not going to work. So how about mental seeing? You might think, well, you know, if not physical, then perhaps there's something in the soul, a kind of perceptual ability that's not physical, but it's capable of having a kind of experience of immaterial reality. Aquinas thinks that's also not going to work either for the beatific vision, and here's why. So if I ask you right now to think about all the reality of insect life, all of it, all at once, in a single thought. You could try to do that, and you could pretty much guess how that would go. You're probably starting to think of particular kinds of insects and you're slotting them in. You're thinking, okay, I remember caterpillars. Oh, I forgot cockroaches. There's ants, right? Ants, bees, wasps. But you notice what you're doing is you're creating a kind of shopping list where you're grasping them, and as you're thinking of new species, you're letting go of the other ones, right? So there doesn't seem to be any way even of holding together in one single intellectual glance the whole of insect reality all at once. So our minds, for our mental seeing, are just not strong enough to be able to pull all of that even limited reality together into a single thought, right? If you think of the mind as a flashlight, we can only light up tiny little segments of reality at a time. So Aquinas thinks, look, if we've got this problem already in terms of accessing finite being with our minds, how are we going to take the infinity and the perfection of sheer existence that God is and have a kind of single glance, mental glance, to be able to experience God as he really is? So he describes this using Aristotle's famous example of the eyes of the owl, where the eyes of the owl only really function in dim lighting conditions, but in bright lighting conditions, the owl can't see, and that's like our mental capacities. We don't function very well at high visibility for intellectual objects. So our eyes are just overwhelmed and burnt out by the amount of intensity of being that we would have to be able to absorb all at once. So that leaves Aquinas with a kind of problem. How are we going to make philosophical sense of the idea of a finite mental capacity being able to grasp an intellect, an object infinitely above us? So what does he do? He turns to our friend from Cordoba, Averroes. Now, Averroes doesn't have a theory of the beatific vision. In fact, he probably thinks that human beings don't have an afterlife. But he does have a kind of analogous problem that he's also trying to solve, because he's tapping into a part of the Aristotelian tradition that wants to argue that beholding with your mind, beholding the highest realities, is the perfection of the human being. So yes, we start with knowing things in the world, with knowing what it is to be a cat and doing geometry and these kinds of things, but that's not where the ultimate completion of our intellectual powers lie. Ultimately, we're oriented, we're not satisfied until we're united with whatever's on the next level of being up from us. And for Averroes, that's a pure intellect. So there's a kind of cosmic mind, a series of cosmic minds for Averroes that are between God and human beings. And our beatitude in this life is to somehow come to contemplate them. But they're higher than we are, and so there's a kind of, again, a kind of mismatch problem. So Averroes handles this. It's kind of an interesting solution that he suggests, with two key principles. So he basically introduces, or takes on board, he's going to invent it for the first time, he takes on board a theory of knowing as a transformation of the human being. It's something that, a change that happens to you. And then correlative claim, number two, through study, each time that you learn something, your mind is continually acquiring new capacities. So as you, it's not like the capacity of the mind is finite and you're just filling up a little bit of it as you're learning. Each new thing that you learn gives you a new and expanded capacity to learn more things. He calls it, in the Latin translation, he calls this a dispositio. That's important to, as we're trying to track the language here. So let's try and get a sense. It's a very strange view, but let's try and get a sense of what Averroes has in mind. So the basic idea is that as you're knowing, that's changing you. It's becoming part of what you know, becomes part of you, and it expands the capacities that your mind has. So suppose you study botany and you learn what a tree is. That becomes a new expanded part of you. It develops the capacity of your mind into in a new direction. Now you decide you're going to go off and you're going to study birds, and you truly understand the nature of birds. Now they've become part of the actualization of your mind, and that's just growing the capacity that you have to learn more things. So this might sound a little bit strange, but I think it's a familiar phenomenon to anybody who plays a musical instrument. I mean, if you think when you start playing a musical instrument, it seems as though your capacity is very, very small. All you can do is play Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star, right? And then, mysteriously, the more you play, the more capacity you develop, right? You didn't start off with the capacity to play a Beethoven piano concerto, right? But you gained that capacity as you developed that potency. Right? So Averroes' idea is that if you can get yourself through study with a philosopher, it's a very rare thing to occur, but he thinks it's possible. The philosopher gets themselves to the point of having complete knowledge of the whole natural world, then the human mind acquires a new capacity, sort of leveling up and expanding the capacity of the mind to be able to grasp realities that are above us and not just at our level. So that's the moment at which the human being is then able to know and behold this higher reality, which is the cosmic intellect. So this is the idea that Aquinas takes on board to account for what happens to the human being that makes the beatific vision possible philosophically. So he thinks it works something along the lines of what Averroes had suggested. So we've got a theory of knowing as a transformation of the mind. We have the idea that the mind's capacity is capable of being expanded. And Aquinas just sort of takes that to a new level, if you will, and says, yes, not just higher beings like intellect, but all the way to the possibility of being able to behold God. Now, and here's the difference with Averroes. Because that he needs that capacity to expand all the way to infinity, right? That's not something that we're going to be able to develop ourselves through study. And that's the big difference between Averroes' view and Aquinas' view. Averroes thinks that if you're a very dedicated philosopher, there's a point in your life where you might be able to expand your mind and know all of reality, all of this level of reality, and be able to acquire the capacity for the next level. But for Aquinas, this is never something that we can develop on our own, and it's something that can only be given as a gift by God. So basically, as a grace, God gives to the human mind a new superhuman capacity. And Aquinas uses this language of aliqua dispositio de novo. It's a phrase that's taken directly from Averroes. And this capacity is a capacity to be transformed by cognitive union with God himself. So we see here a quote from Aquinas on the Summa Contra Gentiles where he says, something must be added to the nature of the human being. So it's a completion of us, but it's something that requires that God give us this new capacity to expand our mind to be able to grasp the infinite object. All right. He describes it, he describes it as light, which is kind of nice, but we could talk about why. That's also very interesting. There's a nice little postscript here. If we read the passage on the Beatific Vision from the Catechism of the Catholic Church, we see the following quote: "Because of his transcendence, God cannot be seen as he is unless he himself opens up his mystery to man's immediate contemplation and gives him the capacity for it." The Church calls the contemplation of God in his heavenly glory the Beatific Vision. And so you see, again, this language of capacity, Aquinas' solution, really became seminal for further developments of Catholic thought on the Beatific Vision. But that's a little echo of a kind of a little conceptual tag, if you will, that goes back to our friend from Cordoba, this notion that an expanded capacity is somehow part of a philosophical solution of how this vision of an infinite reality is possible. So tonight we've just really scratched the surface of the intellectual relationship that there is between the intellectual culture of medieval Islam and the intellectual culture of medieval scholasticism. There's a lot more to be said about it. We could talk about that here in the Q&A. But I think particularly in a moment where there's a lot of talk and a great deal of tension, and sort of political worries about the relationship of Christianity and Islam, it's helpful, I think, to remember that these sort of shared intellectual projects can be the foundation for a kind of cooperation, that this sort of quest for truth is something that people can engage in. And if we see an example of this historically that actually really works. So that, I think, is a useful model for us to reflect on for our own present time as well. Thank you very much.